Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Things aren't always as they appear, and some bombshells might be hiding in plain sight. I'm Katie Bilotti, and this is Found Objects, a storytelling history podcast. Welcome in, everyone. Welcome back to Found Objects History Podcast with me, Katie Bilotti. And today, I will be telling you a scary story. And I don't mean scary in terms of like a horror film or something deadly or gruesome or disgusting. I mean a story that really honestly could have changed, altered the state of our lives as we know it. If you find yourself under the category of foodie, pasta lover, Italian, someone who is not gluten intolerant, any combination of those things, like if you consider yourself a lover of Italian foods and pasta, this story will strike a chord because there was a time in history, would you believe me if I said, pasta was almost banned by a very, very powerful person. And I am just shocked that I didn't know about this until recently. I was actually making a pasta myself. I mean, not from scratch. I had a box of pasta. I was making a sauce from scratch. And I was looking up some recipes online, kind of diving into some Reddit forums about pastas and whatnot. And I came across a fun fact, which isn't so fun, that pasta was almost banned once upon a time. And I decided to delve a bit further. And with the help of my lovely researcher, Sarah, we found a really interesting tale surrounding why pasta was nearly banned. And of course, why, you know, today we're able to eat it and not have any worries about going to jail. So I'll be talking about that today. Also, that being said, kind of in the same grain, there's a bunch of other little stories about other banned foods, some more recent, some still in the past. And it's just really interesting when you start to think about the things that we, you know, often take for granted, you know, just whipping up some pasta, going to, you know, getting some Uber Eats or going to a restaurant or, you know, certain things that we eat and drink every day that at one point in time would have cost us our lives, maybe, potentially, question mark, or just sent us to jail. And even today, some people risk it for the biscuit, not biscuits literally, but like other foods that they could get in some serious trouble for consuming because they are banned. They are illegal in some places. So we're going to dive into that today. Very interesting stuff. Food-related episode. I feel like we keep going back and forth between diamonds and gems and food. So do not worry. Next week, I'm going to shock you with another tale of or story about a person, a life story sort of thing that will shock you that I've been working on alongside Sarah, my researcher. And it's just, it's a really interesting story. So if you're sick of the food stuff, which how could you be, just wait till next week. And as a reminder, I post episodes every Wednesday morning around like 6 a.m. I pop out a new episode of this podcast. Please tell your friends about it. Please rate us 5 stars if possible. I just want to keep the momentum going and keep pumping out great episodes for you, which I plan on doing. And at this point, as I'm recording this, we're completely ad-free. I just want this to be a fun, interesting experience for us all, not bothered by ads. At this point in time, of course, that could change at some point, but for right now, I'm just having fun with it. It's my passion project. So thank you guys for supporting this fun little corner of the internet called Found Objects. And with that, I think we get into the episode, shall we? All right, let me tell you a story, which of course begins with a few questions to consider because, you know, I always have questions. Have you ever considered why food is so different from destination to destination, from place to place when you travel? Not only at restaurants, but also in grocery stores. And I'm not talking about food culture disparities. I'm talking more literally. Like, why can I get bright red hot Cheetos in the United States, but not overseas in Europe? What about Mountain Dew or Little Debbie dessert rolls? This is typically due to differences in food regulations between the U.S. and other countries. For example, food in the U.S., as you might know, is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, and in Europe, they're governed and regulated by the European Food Information Council. And I think about this personally. I actually, how many years ago? It was like probably 6 years ago. Yeah, was that when I was a senior in college? Maybe. I went to Hong Kong, and I remember, don't ask me why, I was in college. I was dumb. I don't know. I mean, not dumb, but I was just doing things, right? I'm in college. I went to McDonald's in Hong Kong. We had all these very interesting food tour destinations and whatnot, but I was just like in the midst of trying all these very new foods. I also don't really eat seafood. I was like, I just need something that reminds me of home. So I went to McDonald's and I was shocked because they had so many different things there. And you might think about it, like when I was in London recently, I would say, like, I don't think that the London McDonald's is all that different when compared to the United States McDonald's, but you'll see, like, in France, like, different countries, they have, like, different menus that are kind of culturally relevant in the given place you go. Like, McDonald's is a prime example of this. Like, things are different. I was in Hong Kong, and I found they had sushi at this one McDonald's I went to, literally. Anyway, so the bottom line is this. The U.S. allows additives in foods that are illegal in many other countries. And allow me to get on my soapbox for a hot second here, running through some of these additives, because of course we know the FDA, there's so many books, so many movies on this. You know, it's kind of this mythical institution where we're like, how do they, why do they, like just so many questions surrounding the Food and Drug Administration. But just to list a few of these additives that are indeed illegal in many other countries, but are fully legal here, here are a few. Ractopamine is used to increase lean muscle in animals. It's commonly found in American pork products, but it's known to cause heart problems in humans. Potassium bromate is used to make bread fluffier and rise higher, but can cause bronchitis. Brominated vegetable oil is used to keep the flavor in soda from floating to the surface. It's primarily used in Mountain Dew in the U.S., but it can cause irritation of your skin, mouth, nose, and lungs. Alestra is a fat-free substitute but causes bloating and intestinal problems. And, okay, this is a hard one. Azodicarbonamide is used to bleach flour but can cause asthma. Coloring agents used in things like hot Cheetos, Skittles, Little Debbie rolls are linked to neurological problems such as brain cancer, ADD, and ADHD. BHA and BHT, I know a lot of letter acronyms here, BHA and BHT, which are used in popular snacks like Wheat Thins and cereals, so Frosted Flakes, Honey Bunches of Oats, and Rice Krispies, are also linked to cancer and kidney or thyroid issues. RBGH is injected into cows to increase milk production and causes many issues in cows, but also causes allergic reactions in humans. So, I know I just sounded like the end of a Super Bowl commercial about some drug, but you probably have gathered the point that I'm trying to make here. For obvious reasons, all of these additives are banned in Europe and other countries across the world. So why does the FDA in the US allow it if it's clearly connected to a myriad of health issues? Well, these chemicals make American food products visually appealing, long-lasting, and more satisfying to eat. And you may be thinking that this helps food corporations sell more products. But let's be real. What the consumer wants most is the things that they've grown to know and love, the things that they've grown up eating, the things that they are used to eating. It's kind of, you know, become part of their routine. Are you willing to give up your favorite cereal? I didn't think so. Hence, the reasons are twofold. And I promise we're not just going to keep talking about the US and the FDA over here. There are some other things I'll be touching on worldwide. So just to make that clear. But of course, I think anyone in any other country is aware that in the US, we have some issues with the Food and Drug Administration or just like things that you're like, I don't know about that. You know, and there's all these documentaries coming out about like, should we be eating this? Should we be eating that? And at the end of the day, it's like, I'm exhausted trying to keep it all straight. Like, I feel like it just shouldn't be on the shelf if it's going to hurt me, right? Like, that's just my thought. Anyway, so the reasons why these foods are still on the shelves, despite having some clear risks, there are many reasons that I just listed. But not only that, the FDA is reactionary. They allow additives in our foods until proven harmful. On the contrary, Europe will only allow certain additives in food after they've been proven to be unharmful. The EU FIC has some of the strictest food safety standards in the world, making Europeans extra confident in the food they purchase and consume. But it is possible to have too much of a good thing. How far is too far, especially with government intervention? Isn't that the whole point of democracy, giving the people the right to partake in decisions made by their government rather than being told what is best for them? Has there ever been a time when government went too far with banned foods or additives? And of course, that's like a tee up to what we'll be talking about today. I'm so glad you asked. That's what we're going to be delving into today. So perhaps not for the additives part of that conversation, but simply because it was believed to be generally bad for you, dictator Benito Mussolini tried to ban pasta in Italy back in the 1920s and 1930s. Yeah, two parts of that are concerning. First, the fact that he thought he could ban pasta, but also in Italy, you know? Pasta is like the backbone of Italian culture. I know you're thinking, like, that sounds insane, and trust me, it did not go over well. So why in the world would he do that? The short answer is Benito Mussolini was a fascist leader. The long answer is that his political ideology emphasizes strong centralized government control, often led by a single leader with dictatorial powers. We'll just say that. Hence why Benito Mussolini was able to single-handedly ban pasta. But hold the phone. First, I want to properly introduce and discuss Benito Mussolini, because he's a very interesting character. If you didn't take world history during your formative years of education, you likely only recognize the name. You probably don't even know what he did or why he was such a controversial leader in Europe. And you know what? That's fine. That's fine. I'm not here to shame you for not knowing, because truly, I only knew the bare bones of who this guy was. So allow me to give you a Cliff Notes version refresher of his life. Benito Mussolini was born on July 29th, 1883 in Predappio, Italy, and he would rise to become one of the most significant political figures of the 20th century. He left a profound impact on Italian and world history as the founder of fascism and Italy's leader during the interwar period, so between World War I and World War II. His father, Alessandro Mussolini, was a blacksmith, but more importantly, he was a loud and proud socialist, which influenced Mussolini's early political views. You know, it's pretty typical, I feel like, when you're growing up, you're very impressionable, you kind of adopt whatever your parents are kind of feeling at the time when you're very young. And then, of course, you grow to make your own decisions. But his father was a blacksmith, and, you know, we can kind of assume he didn't make a ton of money and maybe, you know, cared about the workers and obviously himself included, and didn't love the idea of having like all the resources and money in the hands of large corporations and the state and whatnot, and wanted more of a socialist approach to things. So that being said, you know, Mussolini kind of was like, okay. And when I say Mussolini, I mean Benito Mussolini. He kind of was like, all right, Dad, cool. But as he got older, he started to develop his own extreme political opinions and started to slowly stray away from socialism, interestingly. He became a teacher, but was quickly dismissed due to his questionable political activities outside of work. From there, Benito Mussolini, he moved to Switzerland to evade military service and became involved in socialist politics there. So interesting. He's like having his own beliefs, but then like back to socialism. I think he's just kind of confused at this point. So the apple still hadn't fallen far from the tree at this point in our story, but yeah, just wait. In the early 1900s, Mussolini returned to Italy and began working as a journalist and editor for socialist newspapers. And this is when he went rogue. He formed his own political ideology, which blended elements of socialism, nationalism, and anti-liberalism. He grew disillusioned with the internationalist aims of socialism after all of his time working for the socialist cause, and instead advocated for a more nationalistic and militaristic form of government, which is interesting considering he fled to Switzerland to avoid military service. Like, just interesting that he's into that now. But this culminated in him founding the Fasci Italiani di Combattimento in 1919, which later became known as the National Fascist Party. In the wake of economic turmoil and political instability in Italy following World War I, Mussolini capitalized on popular discontent. To efficiently spread his message and gain support during this time, he needed boots on the ground. So he created a paramilitary squad called the Black Shirts, which was composed largely of war veterans and unemployed youths. They engaged in violent street battles with socialist and communist groups, presenting themselves as a superior class and champions of law and order. By 1922, there were rumblings of a communist revolution in Italy, so Mussolini orchestrated the March on Rome. Under his command, tens of thousands of fascist supporters stormed the capital. King Victor Emmanuel III, fearing a civil war, appointed Mussolini as the prime minister, effectively handing him the power. I know the king really didn't have a choice at this point because, of course, like, he had this tens of thousands of fascist army kind of storming him and kind of forcing his hand, but if only he knew what he was getting himself into by handing over that sort of power to Mussolini. But yeah, and I promise if you are not into like the politics of this all, this story, and you want to just get into the pasta, we will be there shortly. But this is very crucial context that will make sense in like 5 minutes. So Mussolini then after that, after he was handed this, you know, prime minister power position, he quickly consolidated his control over Italy, transforming the country into a one-party dictatorship. He centralized authority, suppressed political opposition, and imposed strict censorship. His regime pursued aggressive nationalist policies, seeking to expand Italy's influence and territories. And just kind of in a nutshell, Benito Mussolini, his rule was characterized by his cult-like personality and a strong emphasis on propaganda. He widely promoted the idea of the, quote, New Roman Empire, envisioning Italy as this modern successor to the ancient Roman civilization. Internationally, Mussolini pursued alliances with other authoritarian regimes, most notably, as you might know, Nazi Germany under Adolf Hitler. The two leaders formed the Rome-Berlin Axis, and Italy entered World War II on the side of the Axis powers in 1940. You might know that part. Like, that part is a pretty big piece of history that most of us have learned and know, probably still think about. But before that point, Mussolini's military ventures were largely disastrous. Italian forces suffered defeats in North Africa, the Balkans, and eventually on the Eastern Front. So why did Mussolini think that he added any sort of value to the Axis powers? The world may never know. He had a false sense of confidence, even given this list that I just listed of failures militarily. But as the tides turned against them in World War II, internal turmoil grew in Italy again. And the discontented people were largely against the fascist leader from the get-go anyway, so Benito Mussolini's popularity was tanking fast. And that probably stressed him out, because what if really angry people do when they are not happy with, you know, the way things are going politically, you know, harm could come to you, right? In 1943, facing the imminent collapse of his regime, Benito Mussolini was ousted from power by the king. Finally, he got his balls back and did what needed to be done, and he was arrested. He was not detained for long because he was quickly rescued by German forces and installed as the head of the Italian Social Republic, a puppet state in northern Italy. As Allied forces advanced, Mussolini's power continued to decline, so he literally escaped. Like, he ran from responsibility, booked it away with his mistress, and hit the road. Such a coward. In April of 1945, he attempted to flee to Switzerland, but was captured by Italian partisans. Benito Mussolini and his mistress, Clara Battaci, were executed by firing squad on April 28th, 1945, near Lake Como. And there you have it. That was the shortened version of Benito Mussolini's life, which of course gives us some context for the next part of our story, but that is, you know, the beginning to end of Benito Mussolini. And what an end to the life of a man who was almost no better than Hitler. His story is complex, controversial, marked by his transformation from a socialist agitator to a fascist dictator, like such a jump, and his significant impact on Italian and world history during that period of between World War I and World War II. So, but let's circle back to the pasta, the most important thing here, how it got banned, why, all the things. And to do that, we need to kind of go back a few minutes to like midway through the story of Benito Mussolini's life when I said he was given the prime minister role from the king. Like he was like, here, I'm scared, take this role. And Benito Mussolini as prime minister, he tried everything in his power to control every aspect of life in Italy. Like he was obsessed, very power hungry. And he did exactly what dictators are kind of notorious for doing, you know, trying to just control every aspect of every citizen's life. And food consumption and food production was no exception here. Like, if you really want to control someone, control what they eat and when they eat, and you kind of have them wrapped around your finger. Because obviously, eating is essential for life, and, you know, changes to that can kind of make people go nuts. So this led to him banning pasta. First, Mussolini tried to convince people that pasta was simply bad for you. He said, avoid pasta because it's a public health concern. Pasta makes you fat, which gives us worthless, lazy soldiers, things like that. But really, it was banned as a precautionary economic measure. Like, that is the truth here. That is why he wanted it gone. Mussolini became more wary of his relationships with other countries leading up to World War II, especially as he got closer with Hitler's Germany. So he wanted to make Italy more reliant on Italian crops rather than imports. One of the country's highest volume imports was flour from Turkey for, you guessed it, pasta. His alternative solution was a pivot to rice, which grew in abundance in northern regions of Italy, and they also tried to incorporate more domestically grown products like tomatoes, olive oil, and wine. Banning pasta and focusing only on those Italian goods, the tomatoes, the olive oil, the wine, the rice, was supported by a group called the Futurists. Futurism was an early 20th century social and artistic movement that originated in Italy. The movement's founder was a man named Filippo Tommaso Marinetti. Marinetti was a jack of many trades. He was an Italian poet, an editor, and the credited founder of the Futurist movement. He was born in Alexandria, Egypt, and he spent his early years in various European cities due to his father's career as a diplomat. Marinetti studied law in Paris, but later turned to literature and the arts. And he's best known for his manifesto, The Foundation and Manifesto of Futurism, which called for the rejection of traditional values and the celebration of modern technology, speed, and dynamicism. He advocated for the destruction of cultural things, like cultural institutions, and to embrace violence, pretty much, is like what Marinetti wanted, and that kind of gave birth to futurism. Like, he thought it was an artistic thing to embrace violence, which, okay, dude, what? The futurist movement with Marinetti, nutty Marinetti at the helm, and the fascist movement with Mussolini leading were closely intertwined. Marinetti was a fervent supporter of Italian nationalism and embraced the ideals of fascism, aligning himself with Benito Mussolini. Like, they were kind of thick as thieves in a way, and he was even the co-author of the 1919 Fascist Manifesto. In 1930, during the height of Mussolini's reign, Marinetti published a cookbook that spoke against a dependence on pasta in alignment with fascist and futurist principles. So they literally made pasta political. Like, when pasta gets political, it's just kind of bonkers. So Marinetti wrote, quote, I hereby announce the imminent launch of futurist cooking to totally renew the Italian way of eating and fit it in as quickly as possible to produce the new heroic and dynamic strengths required of the rice. The rice. Pasta, however agreeable to the palate, he's saying pasta tastes good, but he says, quote, it's the passeist food because it makes people heavy, brutish, deludes them into thinking it's nutritious, makes them skeptical, slow, pessimistic, besides which, patriotically, it's preferable to substitute rice. So basically, this futurist propaganda boasted that consuming domestically sourced rice makes healthy soldiers, strong mothers, you know, just better people. And, you know, stronger children, all of the above. Like, rice should be prioritized over pasta because pasta makes you, you know, irritable, slow, fat, all the things. Like, that was kind of what he was saying and spreading to kind of, you know, back the agenda of Mussolini, which was to preserve the economic resources and whatnot. But they were just essentially lying to the public, like saying these things, lying, which you can't help but think, like, some of these things have kind of translated into our daily lives. Like, I, you know, I've struggled with eating and things like mentalities surrounding eating for years in like small ways, like nothing too concerning. But like, you know, I'll have like a day where I eat something and I'm kind of regretting that I ate that or whatnot. And pasta sometimes falls into that category. And I'm like, wait a minute. No, I should be grateful that I'm eating this pasta. It's delicious. I love it. Why am I so stressed about it? Like, maybe I still have a tinge of what Marinetti was cooking up here. This, like, these lies. You know, everything in moderation. And pasta is so good. Pasta is so good. And of course, Mussolini had other ideas. Like, it wasn't just the economic preservation of, like, you know, and keeping things in-house, keeping things in Italy that was motivating him. It was also, he wanted control. He wanted to control people. And how better to control people than through what they eat and banning a very important food group in Italian life. Like, I, you know, when you think Italy, a lot of times you think pasta. And those are my ancestors. Like, it's just kind of mad to think that we could, like, grow up without spaghetti and angel hair and bucatini and, like, all the good things. So what Mussolini did not account for was just how much the Italian people loved their pasta. It was a pillar of their Italian heritage, like I just said. So for the anti-fascists and anti-futurists, the people that didn't agree with Mussolini or Marinetti, those two guys, you know, they kind of used pasta in an opposite way as a symbol of resistance. They were like, we're going to use this and this is going to be our symbol. Quote, consuming pasta was marked as an affront to Italian nationalism. So like an FU to Italian nationalism. They're like, we're keeping our pasta and you guys should support us because of that. Like, it kind of backfired on Mussolini because he didn't realize, like, just how important this would be to people, like banning this food group, you know? The ban also resulted in a series of labor strikes across Italy. To make matters even worse for Mussolini, he failed miserably in his attempt to replace imported flour with homegrown rice in Italians' diets. This fundamental lack of volume of rice led to food shortages leading up to World War II, which is not great. As you can imagine, it was not smart to go to war with hungry soldiers, which then impacted their performance in the war. So, yeah, this, we all remember how that ended for Hitler and Mussolini, how the war ended, like, we know all that probably, but the already wary Italian public were now outright angry. I should say hangry with their country's leadership because, of course, like I said, Mussolini was trying to push rice and he didn't even have the means to feed everyone with the rice. So everyone was pissed. Everyone was hungry and pissed right up to World War II, which ultimately this led to Mussolini being ousted in 1943, as I mentioned earlier. The death by firing squad, all that stuff, like that happened after this. More importantly, with Mussolini gone, pasta was back. So yes, it was gone. They were trying to push rice. The people weren't having it. They used it as a political tool. You know, it was their political symbol, anti-Mussolini, anti-futurism. And then once Mussolini was ousted, pasta was back. It was saved. And its impact on Italian culture could prosper now in the public eye once more. Like before, people would have to sneak it. Like it was kind of like a prohibition sort of thing where, you know, it was illegal, right? So believe it or not, though, pasta is not the only food that was notoriously banned in history. Can we even talk about banned foods without touching on, like I just said, prohibition in the U.S.? The Prohibition era began in 1920 when the 18th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution went into effect. And I love talking about Prohibition because it gave us one of the most amazing things. Like, obviously, terrible time to be someone who loved martinis back in that time period. But today, it gave us speakeasies, which I love a speakeasy, okay? In New York City, there's so many, I'm sure, and obviously I know this, in many other cities, there's other speakeasies, but here in New York, there are some amazing speakeasies that just give you such a vibe, like you're in a different time. It's like mysterious. It's like you're doing something forbidden and, you know, you're in like the basement or like behind a, my favorite one has like this, it's a fridge door, like a refrigerator door. You open it. It's like in like a, it looks like a deli and you open the refrigerator door and it's a door to a bar. Like, anyway, I digress. So back in this time, this was 1920 and the 18th Amendment in the US Constitution went into effect. And this banned the manufacture, transportation, and sale of intoxicating liquors. Some people may not realize that the consumption of alcohol was still very much legal. So the consumption, let me make this clear. Something I learned more recently actually is the fact that in Prohibition, you could consume, you could drink alcohol. Like that was not illegal. It was the manufacture, transportation, and sale of liquor that was illegal. So if you were one of those people that, you know, primarily rich people who stockpiled alcohol in your cellar, you know, and just had it for miles, for days, for years, you'd be fine. You know, technically any wine, beer, or spirits Americans had stashed away before January 1920 was theirs to keep and enjoy in the privacy of their homes. So of course, you know, you have to think a lot of people were like, you know, if they were found with alcohol that was bootlegged and they got from someone else, they'd be like, oh, I had this before. You know, for most people who didn't think ahead, this is kind of giving me vibes of like 2020 COVID when toilet paper ran out and people didn't think like, oh, I should, you know, stock up on toilet paper and like Clorox wipes and Purell. Like all these things were like kind of like a delicacy in the US at least because people just, you know, were going crazy. Understandably, it was a very unprecedented time, of course, but yeah. So, you know, for the people that didn't think ahead, that didn't think to stockpile their liquor and beer and wine and whatnot, or just didn't have the means to do it, didn't have the wealth to do it, this led to the purchase of bootlegged liquor. And this usually included bathtub gin and rot gut moonshine. These beverages had an extremely foul taste, and those desperate enough to drink it also ran the risk of being struck blind or even poisoned. So you run the risk. You gotta risk it for the buzz. Speaking of quirky, dangerous alcohol, have you ever heard of absinthe? So yes, that Prohibition little backstory leads us to absinthe. This infamous liquor was banned in numerous countries, not just the US during the Prohibition era, but for reasons weirder than you might think. It was banned due to its questionable and strange effect on people. Absinthe is a highly alcoholic spirit known for its distinctive green color and strong herbal flavor. It's traditionally made from a base of neutral alcohol, which is infused with botanicals like anise, wormwood, and fennel. The inclusion of wormwood, and specifically the compound called thujone found within it, is what made it legendary and controversial. It's typically bottled at a high proof, often around 60 to 70% alcohol by volume, RIP, making it one of the strongest spirits ever available on the market. It's traditionally consumed by diluting it with water, which makes sense because it's such a high proof and it probably, you know, would be best consumed that way. I remember growing up when I would want apple juice, like I would want any really sort of juice, and my mom would always dilute the juice with water because she was afraid of me having all that sugar in my system. So I'd assume it's something similar to that. But, you know, so when you dilute it with water, it causes it to turn cloudy due to the essential oils in it, in the botanicals, becoming insoluble in the water. So yes, that's what it looks like when it's diluted with water. Fun fact, the origins of absinthe can be traced back to ancient Egypt and Greece, where the herbal concoction was typically used for medicinal purposes. However, the modern form of absinthe gained popularity in Switzerland and France in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. A particularly influential figure in the development of absinthe was Pierre Ordinaire, which is an amazing name. Like, I can't get over that. Pierre Ordinaire. Anyway, Pierre, he was a French doctor who is said to have formulated a version of the tonic in the late 18th century. He's often cited in the myth and lore surrounding absinthe, but interestingly, there are no historical records that indicate that Ordinaire even existed. You know, I should have known. Too good to be true. A name like that, Pierre Ordinaire, come on. Like, he can't actually exist. So maybe Pierre is a legend himself. Regardless, while the mysterious beverage absinthe was popular, concerns about its safety and alleged psychoactive effects led to its prohibition in many countries during the early 20th century. So people were like, we can't have this. It's spooky. It was said to cause hallucinations, madness, and even violent behavior. And these allegations were fueled by high-profile cases where individuals allegedly, under the influence of absinthe, committed crimes or exhibited erratic behavior. For example, one of the most infamous incidents linked to absinthe is the Lanfray murders, which occurred in Switzerland in 1905. Jean Lanfray, a Swiss laborer, murdered his wife and two children before attempting suicide. Absinthe was found to be present in his bloodstream at the time of the murders, leading to sensationalized media coverage and calls for absinthe prohibition. This case played a significant role in the subsequent banning of absinthe in Switzerland. Interestingly, many familiar names in literature and art are coincidentally connected to absinthe. When Vincent van Gogh infamously cut off his ear back in France in 1888, many theories suspect that his consumption of absinthe may have contributed to that fragile mental state. Oscar Wilde famously declared, quote, "A glass of absinthe is as poetical as anything in the world. What difference is there between a glass of absinthe and a sunset?" Sounds like a guy who drank too much absinthe said that. Ernest Hemingway called it, quote, "opaque, bitter, tongue-numbing, brain-warming, stomach-warming, idea-changing, liquid alchemy," saying, quote, "it's supposed to rot your brain out, but I don't believe it. It only changes the ideas." It may be a beverage shrouded in mystery, famous names, and untimely deaths, but ultimately, modern research has shown that many of the myths surrounding absinthe are simply untrue or embellished. While it is a potent alcoholic beverage, there's little evidence to support that it's more harmful or hallucinogenic than other high-proof spirits. As a result, absinthe has experienced a resurgence in popularity in recent years, with many countries lifting their bans or relaxing regulations on its production and sale. And I just had a memory pop into my head. I think, yeah, this had to have been more than probably like 8 years ago. I was on a work trip, like, and I say work, I was in high school. No, I was in college. But I was on this like brand trip, like one of my very first, and we were in London. Yeah, we had to have been in London because I went on this L'Oreal brand trip before I ended up working for them in corporate. And I remember the person that was in charge of the trip was like, "We're going to an absinthe bar." And I was so, well, first of all, I was under 21, so I like didn't drink anything alcoholic there because, again, work. Of course, I was in college, things happened, but I was, you know, on a work trip, so I was very good. I drank my water, but I was mystified by this absinthe bar. Like, everything was an absinthe drink. And I remember just like hearing things from school. Like, I learned something about absinthe in school, and I was like, oh my God, are these people gonna die? Like, I was concerned. But there are bars that are dedicated to absinthe drinks. So the notorious ban on pasta and absinthe, obviously for different reasons, both ended up being trivial. Because let's face it, pasta is not that bad for you, and absinthe is just as bad as any other alcohol, so just be aware of your limit, is kind of the moral of the story with those two. But some things really do have a bad rap, and for good reason. In the US, which we know, like I said in the very beginning, we're notorious for having very loose food standards compared to the rest of the world. What are some food practices deemed so questionable that they're even banned in the US? When things are already so lax over here, it seems like, compared to other places, like, there are some things that are banned here, which says a lot. Like, if it is banned here, it must be real bad, you know? Shark fins, beluga caviar, and Japanese puffer may ring a bell as being these banned things here, but how about milk? Specifically, unpasteurized milk. Yes, there's a lot of chatter about unpasteurized milk over on TikTok, I've noticed, but let's debunk that today. So we briefly discussed that milk in the US sometimes has this property or this thing called RBGH in it, which is an additive given to cows to increase milk production that often has adverse effects on humans as well. But the debate between pasteurized and unpasteurized is also a tricky subject. It's different, but in some U.S. states, unpasteurized milk is actually illegal. But before we get into that, let's unpack the difference between the two. You might actually think, if you've seen Schitt's Creek, there's an episode where Alexis, like, I don't know, I think it's Mr. Rose, wants to buy unpasteurized milk because he can sell it on the black market or something like that. And Alexis, like, does his dirty work and, like, goes or gets a guy to go get it or whatnot. And she gets way too much and he freaks out because it's, like, too much to be moving. And yeah, there's a whole scene about this in Schitt's Creek. But pasteurized milk undergoes a process that involves heating the milk to a specific temperature, which is usually around 161 degrees Fahrenheit or 71.7 degrees Celsius for a set period, then rapidly cools it down. This process is intended to kill harmful bacteria like E. coli, salmonella, and listeria that may be present in the milk without significantly affecting its taste or nutritional value. Pasteurized milk is the most common type of milk available in supermarkets and is generally considered safer to consume. Unpasteurized milk, also known as raw milk, is milk that has not undergone the pasteurization process, obviously, and is consumed in its natural state. Some proponents of raw milk argue that it contains beneficial enzymes, probiotics, and nutrients that may be destroyed or altered during pasteurization, resulting in a healthier product. However, unpasteurized milk can pose health risks, as it may contain harmful bacteria, parasites, and other pathogens that can cause foodborne illnesses like tuberculosis and other infections. Due to these potential risks, many health authorities, including the FDA, recommend against consuming unpasteurized milk, especially for vulnerable populations. But the tides are turning, and it's becoming legal in dozens of states across the U.S. But that being said, there's many regulations regarding where they can sell the raw milk, the size of the farm, and the disinfecting practices. Nonetheless, it is widely legal now, despite the mainstream public health warnings and such, and people on TikTok speaking out about it or speaking for it. Like, I've seen debates about raw milk versus pasteurized milk running rampant on social media. Iowa is one of the latest states to hop on the bandwagon. Starting on July 2023, Iowa legalized the sale of raw milk via direct sales only. So in other words, directly from the producer to the consumer. So, directly from. This is one of the more conservative approaches, as several states allow raw milk sales in grocery stores, like California, Maine, New Mexico, and Washington, to name a few. Iowa's raw milk bill states that farms may have no more than 10 animals and producers must test the animals monthly for harmful bacteria, like E. coli. Again, it must be sold directly from producers to consumers, which means it can't be sold at stores, restaurants, farmers markets, etc. And the milk jugs must include a label clearly stating that the milk is unpasteurized and has not been inspected by the FDA as well. While that may seem reasonable considering the risks, some critics worry that the new law's 10-animal limit could inadvertently encourage untrained hobbyists to get into the business. Which, if you think about it, yeah, like, how hard is it if you want to make some money? Because, of course, unpasteurized milk, harder to get, it's going to be more expensive. You know, how hard is it to have just 10 random animals on your farm and then sell this stuff that's like liquid gold to some people? Yeah. Like, people are worried about that, so it has to be enforced somehow. As Mary McGonigal Martin, a board member of the national food safety group called Stop Foodborne Illness, testified, quote, producing raw milk is not like growing vegetables in your backyard and selling them. This hasn't deterred the excitement for these small-scale farmers. Stacy Wistock, a distributor of raw goat milk in Iowa, is confident that the raw milk she'll sell will be clean, but she also acknowledged that any food product can, of course, carry risks. Hence, it is wise to be wary of consuming raw milk if you have a weak immune system or are feeding it to children. Either way, many people say that restrictive laws about foods are a matter of freedom. People should be able to choose what they want to consume and how they want to live their lives. And as history tells us, you might as well end food restrictions because people will find a way to consume it anyway. They might even make it a symbol of their movement, you know, just like the Italians did with the pasta, just like the Swiss and French did with their absinthe. So there you have it, guys. A few micro stories in one episode about banned foods in the world. Banned, I guess, also drinks. Foods and drinks, if you consider the milk and the absinthe drinks, which I guess they are. But yeah, guys, wow. What an episode. Just chock full of random facets of food history. I bet you've never thought twice about your favorite pasta and wine combo, you know, potentially being obsolete, like not being a thing today because of a fascist dictator. You know, it's just like kind of crazy that this could have become a thing. And, you know, it's just such a big part of me is my pasta. So I don't know how I could live like that. We must thank our lucky stars and outspoken people from history for saving our pasta and our right to drink and, you know, whatever else you believe in terms of banned foods and drinks. But yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode on, you know, modern food trends in the wild period of time when banning food was the name of the game. So both, a little marriage of history and something a bit more current, like the raw milk craze is a more current thing, but of course, the banning of absinthe, pasta, and prohibition in general was a more, you know, obviously it's been like 100 years or more since then. Anyway, guys, hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you so much for listening and supporting the podcast. Thank you all for listening, and remember, things are not always as they appear. Goodbye. This episode was produced, edited, and told by Katie Bellotti. Research by Sarah Schilling. Podcast artwork by Siri Devlin. Follow us on Instagram at Found Objects Podcast. Tune in next Wednesday for a new episode.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.